for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Hugo Chavez steps up to the microphone at the United Nations, calls George Bush the devil. He says the devil came here yesterday. He came here as if he were the owner of the world. He says it still smells of sulfur. A little hyperbole, but I'm frankly I'm surprised even that Chavez would, you know. In any case, and yesterday Ahmadinejad called for the end of all nuclear weapons and said that nuclear weapons are against his religion, and that their entire weapon or their entire uranium enrichment program is under the careful supervision of the IAEA. That's interesting. At the same time, just kind of a quick update here. While the Senate Intelligence Committee said, quote, Saddam Hussein was distrustful of al-Qaeda and viewed Islamic extremists as a threat to his regime, refusing all requests from al-Qaeda to provide material or operational support, Saddam issued a general order that Iraq should not deal with al-Qaeda. No post-war information suggests that the Iraqi regime attempted to facilitate a relationship with bin Laden, end quote. Nonetheless, days later, the White House released a fact sheet.
The rest of the story, Iraq's links to al-Qaeda,
which is full of, I don't know how else to say it, lies. In the meantime, the Islamo-fascist meme seems to have been put to bed. Condi Rice has prevailed upon George Bush to stop using the phrase. It antagonizes Muslims around the world, and besides that, it's not accurate. Fascism, the merging of corporate and state interests, has very little to do with theocracy, which is what the Muslim extremists are really pitching. But apparently Chuck Morse didn't get the memo. ChuckMorse.com. Chuck, a Boston area radio talk show host, a syndicated columnist who's regularly featured on WorldNet Daily, host of his own cable TV show, Morse Code. Chuck is running as Republican against Barney Frank in the 4th Congressional District of Massachusetts, a seat held by Barney Frank. And Chuck, a fellow I've known for a couple of years, a colleague, a fellow radio talk show host. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Good to talk with you again, Chuck. You're out there promoting the idea that the Islamists are actually Nazis. Why?
Well, the book that I wrote, The Nazi Connection to Islamic Terrorism, draws a direct connection between the emergence of radical jihadism or radical Islam and Nazism. And by the way, the book also contrasts the emergence of the radical Islamic movement to a more moderate Islamic movement that was suppressed mainly by the radicals in the 1920s and still is, much and oftentimes with the connivance of the liberal Western democracies, who tended to side with the more radical element.
Wouldn't it be more accurate, Chuck, to suggest that the radical Islam has been promoted by this deal that the Saudi royal family, the House of Saud, made with the devil, the Wahhabists, and that it's U.S. oil dollars and frankly, the Bush family over three generations, at least two generations, that have been promoting radical Islam. It's now spreading all over the world, this Wahhabist sect. And that if you want to draw parallels between world leaders and Nazis, George W. Bush's grandfather got busted for doing business with Hitler during the war.
Well, a lot of people were involved with him, including Kennedy's father. But putting that aside, Tom, you're absolutely right about the House of Saud. It was another example of a Western power, Great Britain, in 1920, installing that family in Mecca over the more moderate Hashemite king of Hejaz, who was represented a more progressive and Western view of Islam. Once that party was installed by the British in the 1920s, they basically did control the oil of the Arabian Peninsula after 1945, and Britain was fairly spent at the end of World War II.
This was all done with our help as well.
It was Franklin Roosevelt who met with the Prince of Saud in Alexandria Harbor on his way to Yalta, and who basically agreed that the United States would take over as the protector of the House of Saud. And that has remained in place, and it accentuated during the Cold War, of course, because we didn't want them to fall in the hands of the Soviet Union. But I would contend that now that the Soviet Union is dead, and now that there is no more Cold War, the House of Saud should be deposed. I mean, they are, the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were directly connected with the Saudi Arabian royal family. They're the ones who are funding the madrasas They're the ones who were also allied with the Nazis during the war. And as far as I'm concerned, they should be sent to Guantanamo Bay along with the rest of the terrorists.
But the president that you have sworn loyalty to here, George W. Bush, his family, I mean, over $1 billion over the last 30 years has been transferred directly from Saudi Arabia to entities associated with the Bush family as a consequence of the behavior of the Bush family, principally Bush Sr. And he's kissing the princes and holding their hands and things. I mean, are you repudiating George Bush's connections to the House of Saud?
As I said, Tom, it's not really a partisan issue. Since Franklin Roosevelt, right up to the present administration, whether it be Democrat or Republican, the House of Saud has been propped up by the United States.
But there has been no president who's had that kind of relationship. We have a president right now whose failing oil company, Harkin Oil Company, was bailed out by Osama bin Laden's half-brother, who only was able to become a multimillionaire because of the bin Laden association with the House of Saud.
Every American administration, unfortunately, has played footsie with the Saudis. And it's too bad Clinton did the same thing. They've all done it all the way back to Roosevelt.
But not at a personal level. They did it at a political level.
I don't know the details of that, but I would probably reject it, and it's not really relevant. The important thing is that American foreign policy has supported a family that has represented the Wahhabi, more radical view of Islam, over more moderate Islamic forces. And as long as that family is in control over there, and as long as they do control a quarter of the world's oil reserves, I think that you're going to see a continuation of the Islamic radical movement worldwide. And I think that if we're going
to... I agree with you on that, Chuck, and so here's the question. How do we try to reform Saudi Arabia without screwing it up like we did Iraq or radicalizing them like we're doing Iran right now? How do we bring them to our side?
I think that we, if we stop supporting the Saudis, they would collapse in a minute because it's one of
the most repressive. And they'll be replaced by the very people that you decry, the Wahhabis.
I think we need to, in my opinion, I think that this government, they are the Wahhabis.
No, they're not. The House of Saud is supporting the Wahhabis, but by and large, they're a bunch of sybarites.
No, the House of Saud is the Wahhabi movement. I mean, that is the pinnacle of that movement, and it always has been. And we should bring back, I would call for a return of the more moderate Hashemite dynasty. I think that a Hashemite king, very much like King Abdullah of Jordan, would do very well there with a constitutional monarchy that is Western looking just like Jordan is. And that, in fact, was the government there before the British sided with the Wahhabi Sauds.
I understand. And how do you suggest that we bring this about?
Well, all I can do is suggest that the experts would have to decide how it's done. I mean, I suppose we could send somebody over there and just arrest them. I don't know.
We're back to the United States as the world's policeman. I mean, this is what Hugo Chavez was talking about this morning. George Bush comes to the UN and talks like he owns the planet. Aren't we doing the same thing here, you and I, right now?
As I said, Tom, the United States has been the primary supporter of that family going back to Franklin D. Roosevelt. And we, have the power to choose to we continue with that policy or switch to another policy. If they didn't get the support of the United States that they're getting, they would probably be in a lot of trouble. And I think that there is an incestuous relationship that goes all the way back, as I say, before Roosevelt. It goes back to the British between that family's control of those oil resources and Western powers, and it's a very unholy alliance.
Wouldn't it, Chuck Morris, be a whole lot easier for us to just say, okay, we're going to do a Manhattan Project-style crash program to wean the United States off Middle Eastern oil, period, and then just, leave them to their own devices and problems, let them solve their own stuff? I mean, we wouldn't have had 9/11 if we weren't sucking oil out of that region. Osama bin Laden was quite clear about that.
Well, Tom, I think that this is another area where you and I also agree. I think that the United States needs to become more energy self-sufficient, and I think the way to do that is a combination of supporting alternative forms of energy like wind power, which is a big issue in Massachusetts, and also increasing oil reserves such as up in the north coast of Alaska, and bringing back nuclear power, which, by the way, has been stymied since the 1970s.
Well, in large part because it requires huge subsidies from the public, number one. And number two, a nuclear power plant doesn't produce its first kilowatt of actual generated electricity from nuclear power until its 18th year of operation because of all the oil that goes into finding, refining, you know, moving
the
uranium and everything else.
I think that
it's a lousy way to generate electricity.
Nuclear power is the primary source of energy for France. And for
I know, and it's a disaster for them. It's a disaster. They have, you know, what are they going to do with all this waste?
Well, that's another question.
They're dumping it in third world countries is what they're doing. Chuck Morse, chuckmorse.com, the website. Chuck, thanks for being on the program this morning.
Thank you, Tom. This afternoon. This evening.
All of the above. Good talking to you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Program.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
On September 12th, we had the world on our side. But George Bush, he started to divide. He cut off the UN and our allies too. And now he wants to drive a wedge between me and you. But fear didn't make America great. Fear didn't make America great. Fear didn't make America
great. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Be Bush Dumpers. Be Bush Dumpers on November.
And welcome back to your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. The Tom Hartmann Radio Program, 22 minutes past the hour. Over in our chat room at TomHartmann.com, Benedict at Large says, fairly reasonable con, Tom. Where did you find him? Chuck Morse has been on our show a lot of times over the last 4 years, and all of a sudden he got reasonable on me. I don't understand. Well, it has to do with he's running for Congress. What can you say? But speaking of reason, it's still the Nazi meme out there. I mean, here you got Prescott Bush, W's granddaddy, getting busted by Roosevelt for doing business with Hitler, and we're going to call Muslims Nazis? I'm sorry, it just doesn't wash for me. Meanwhile, here's how weird it gets. I mean, this is just how incredibly weird it gets, and a tip of the hat to Placidus Roy in our chat room for this thing. Over at Glenn Greenwald's blog, Unclaimed Territory, which is glenngreenwald.blogspot.com, is a posting called Well Beyond Satire. And he's talking about Michelle Malkin. She's all flipped out about this. And odds are it's going to be, you know, buzzing around the right-wing blog. It is already buzzing around the right-wing blogosphere. It'll probably show up in a right-wing talk radio. That over in Indonesia, which is by and large a Muslim country, not by and large, I believe it may even officially be a Muslim country. It's the world's largest Muslim country in terms of population. Over at Indonesia, there are three terrorists who have been put on trial and sentenced by a court to death for a terrorist attack that killed 200 people. And Michelle Malkin, the right-wing blogger, writer, one of these kind of Ann Coulter folks, who's a star by virtue of the fact that she's a star because the right, you know, does everything they can to elevate her into the media. Michelle is out there all upset about this, saying that, you know, this should not be the case. They should go before the international, the lawyers for the three convicted terrorists would take their case before the International Criminal Court in Geneva per Human Rights Convention ratified by Jakarta to safeguard the three men's right to life and to denounce irregularities of Indonesian trials. In other words, here we have a right-wing blogger saying terrorists who are convicted of terrorism and killing people in a terror attack should have rights. They should have rights before a court. They should have the right to confront their accusers. They should have a fair trial. They should not be held without being charged with it. And they should, if they're convicted of a death, if they're given a death sentence, they should have the right to appeal at the international level, at the court in Geneva. What, has she been eating mushrooms, smoking something? No, well, here's the rest of the story. The terrorists, the three convicted terrorists in Indonesia who have been sentenced to death for the murder of 200 innocent civilians, these three convicted terrorists are Christians, and the two other people they killed are Muslims. They deserve rights, the Christians. Now, this is the same Michelle Malkin who defends Bush in locking up Muslims in the United States or any other dissidents who aren't part of the Christian Reich and saying, yeah, that Jose Padilla guy, throw away the key. He doesn't need a trial. He doesn't need to be able to face his accuser. I mean, I'm not quoting Michelle Malkin, obviously, but this is the position of the Bush administration, which she so aggressively supports. What? Rights for terrorists? Let's rewrite the Geneva Conventions. I mean, we don't need no stinking rights. This is incredible. It's, as Placidus Roy says, the irony has gone wild. This is well beyond satire. And it really is. Here's Michelle Malkin, all upset, and the right-wing blogosphere, all upset that accused terrorists are not getting a fair trial. While in the United States, we are operating, or on property controlled by the United States in Guantanamo, we're operating now six concentration camps, and God only knows how many outside the country in third world country. We know now roughly 14 to 15,000 people being held without criminal charges, without having an opportunity to face their accusers, without even knowing what they're charged with, possibly having trials in secret, if they ever have a trial, where they could be convicted and given the death sentence based on evidence derived through torture, well, that's no problem if we're doing it. But if the Islamic Republic of Indonesia wants to do that to three Christians, ho-ho, that'll get Bill O'Reilly's dander up. Isn't it weird? I mean, it's just, I don't know how to, I can't characterize it beyond that. It's just sometimes shocking, the hypocrisy of the right. Our number, 1-866-440-8466. With that and more when we come back from the news. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Why don't we liberate these United States? We're the ones who need it worse.
You tell them, Merle.
Let the rest of the world help us for change, and let's rebuild America first. How highways and bridges are falling apart. Who's blessed? Who has been cursed? There's things to be done all over the world, but let's rebuild America first.
Indeed, Merle Haggard there. Boy, when you have lost Merle Haggard, you have lost Middle America, I'll tell you. And he's got an anti-Bush song right on his homepage at merlehaggard.com. Welcome back to the program, 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here in the place where smart people get their news. Hugo Chavez going before the United Nations just a short time ago, criticizing the UN, saying its current system doesn't work, it's anti-democratic. But more than that, he said, we appeal to the people of the United States and to the world to halt this threat, the threat being George W. Bush, domination, exploitation, and pillaging of the people of the world, the neocon policies, he said, which is like a sword hanging over our head. Hugo Chavez. What was interesting yesterday in Ahmadinejad's speech is that he said, and I'm quoting from his speech, he said, the Islamic Republic of Iran reiterates its previously and repeatedly declared position that in accordance with our religious principles, pursuit of nuclear weapons is prohibited. The Islamic Republic of Iran believes it's necessary to revitalize the non-proliferation treaty as I recall, that's the treaty that Bush walked away from when he became president, when he was appointed president by the Supreme Court, and create the above-mentioned ad hoc committee so that it can combat nuclear weapons and abolish the apartheid and peaceful nuclear technology. Technically, the fuel cycle of the Islamic Republic of Iran is not different from that of other countries which have peaceful nuclear technology. And he pledged, he says, in keeping with Iran's inalienable right to have access to a nuclear fuel cycle, continued interaction and technical and legal cooperation with the IAEA will be the centerpiece of our nuclear policy. Initiation and continuation of negotiations with other countries will be carried out in the context of Iran's interaction with the agency. In other words, here's Ahmadinejad saying, hey, we think, in fact, actually, he even called for absolute ban on all nuclear weapons worldwide, starting with a ban on nuclear weapons in the Middle East, which, of course, I guess you'd expect. It's like saying, because the only country in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons is Israel. I don't think that's going to go very far. He says, we need to propose practical measures for the establishment of a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. Yeah, right. But his larger suggestion that the entire world should work toward a nuclear-free world. Well, I remember when U.S. presidents used to talk like that. It's been a while. It's been a long, long time. And George W. Bush yesterday, speaking before the United Nations, and coming up with some interesting comments that, in and out of context. Here's George W. Bush yesterday.
5 years ago, I stood at this podium and called on the community of nations to defend civilization and build a more hopeful future. This is still the great challenge of our time.
Yeah, in large part because you went and invaded a country that represented no threat to us, destabilized the Middle East, screwed things all up, led to the death of 100,000 innocent civilians and thousands, over 20,000 American casualties now. 600 and odd dead and 20,000 injured. I'm not sure I'd be bragging about that, George, if I were you, he continued.
Some have argued that the democratic changes we're seeing in the Middle East are destabilizing the region.
No, nobody's arguing that. It's not the democratic changes that we're seeing in the Middle East. It's your insane invasion of Iraq. That's what's destabilizing the region. So this is a classic right-wing straw man approach. We say, well, some people claim that because I kicked my dog, therefore I must be. But I never kicked my dog, and I can prove it. And whereas people aren't talking about you kicking your dog, they're talking about you burning somebody's house down. I mean, it's like setting up the straw man and then knocking it over. So here's Bush again with this, and he continues. Oh, hang on just a second here. Make this.
Some have argued that the democratic changes we're seeing in the Middle East are destabilizing the region.
Again, no.
This argument rests on a false assumption that the Middle East was stable to begin with.
Well, there is something to be said, actually, for Iraq having been stable to begin with. The people of Iraq could go to work without being shot. There were not executions. There weren't 100 people a day being murdered. Did not live in terror. Women were not wearing the veil.
The reality is that the stability we thought we saw in the Middle East was a mirage.
Okay.
For decades, millions of men and women in the region have been trapped in oppression and hopelessness.
Yeah, okay, I'll agree with you on that.
And these conditions left a generation disillusioned and made this region a breeding ground for extremism.
Yeah, and extremism that was promoted in large part with our dollars going to the Saudi royal family and others in the region who were promoting extremism, but it was not promoted by Saddam Hussein. This is the weird thing. Saddam Hussein hated al-Qaeda. I mean, this is the hated al-Qaeda, Bush continues.
We know that when people have a voice in their future, they are less likely to blow themselves up in suicide attacks.
And that is where he is just completely wrong. What we find is that the willingness of somebody to engage in a suicide attack not only has nothing to do with whether or not they feel that they have any future or what their income is or anything. It's actually, what you find if you dig into it is that virtually all, for example, of the people who are alleged to have blown up the World Trade Center and whatnot, This was middle class to upper middle class to rich people. I mean, just very, the Times of London, for example, runs an article. The current wave of bombers no longer comes from the poor and downtrodden classes seeking a way out of poverty. It includes young men and women from the middle classes with a high level of education and a profession. We are educated strugglers, claims Yunus, a 27-year-old Palestinian graduate I met while he was preparing for a mission. We are not terrorists, and the world should recognize that our acts are not intended to be pure cold-blooded murder. Curiously, he had begun our conversation by talking of his love for art and the paintings of Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and Picasso before abruptly changing the subject to his impending martyrdom. He's talking to a suicide bomber. As Robert Pape points out in his book Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, 95% of all suicide terrorist attacks have the specific goal of forcing democracies to withdraw military forces from territory considered by the terrorists to be their homeland. In fact, the majority of terrorist attacks, suicide attacks around the world as of last year, it's probably changed this year because of Iraq, were even committed by people who are not religious. It was the Tamil Tigers, who profess atheism in Sri Lanka, or variations thereof. So here's another straw man from George W. I mean, it is incredible how people just don't get it. They don't understand, you know, what's going on. The reason people are blowing themselves up, the reason that they're shooting at us in Iraq, is because we are occupying their country. It's just that simple. You want to take a target off the back of the American soldiers, get them out of there. You want to stop destabilizing Iraq, get out of there. But no, George wants to get into Iran. I mean, that's what he's all about. He wants to get into Iran. Cynthia in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. Hey, Cynthia, what's up?
Hey, I'm enjoying what you're saying.
Thank you.
And I was listening to Hugo Chavez. And one thing that struck me, and you and I talked about this pertaining to Iran and John Negroponte, last time I called you was over a month ago, when he said the United States protects terrorism when we want to. He's right. What was the guy's name? Luis Posada, who bombed the Cuban plane over.
That's right.
Crashed in Benton.
And we refused to turn him over to the Cubans for prosecution.
Exactly. Yeah. Emile Constant, the Haitian member of the FROP, who is living openly in New York. Not FROP. What is it? Tonton Macoute.
Yeah.
And then we got Osama. You know, people, we still don't know where he is. I think he's being protected.
Well, actually, yeah, we do.
We
do know where he is. He's being protected by Musharraf, who just signed, North and South Waziristan are now protected territories. And,
right.
And in all probability, that's where Osama is. It's right on the Afghan border. Cynthia, thanks a lot. I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call, though. It's a good point and interesting. Chavez making that point before the United Nations. Amazing. Time now for the Tom Hartman Program's Progressive Pop Quiz for the day. Today's question is, which member of the Bush family did business with Adolf Hitler? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466, gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Once again, our Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question for the day, which member of the Bush family did business with Adolf Hitler? Sixth caller at 440-THOM, 440-8466, gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Amazing. The middle class on its deathbed in the United States. And that, oddly, was not part of the discussion that George was talking about at the UN. And it really should be. You know, the relationship between a middle class and democracy, it is such a critical relationship. We'll be back right after this with your calls and more. It's some incredible news. The Bush administration rewriting history once again, 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Above the Rio Grande, they tell scary tales about the meanest hombre to ever hunt a quail. to the bush to see him scurry with a shotgun in his hand. He never bags a birdie, but he always gets his man. So find the nearest building when you see him pointing quick, and hide your wife and children from the outlaw Dead-Eye Dick.
I'll look out for that Dead-Eye Dick. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States. Congratulations to John Brink of Seattle, Washington, who knew that the answer to the question of our progressive pop quiz today, which member of the Bush family did business with Adolf Hitler, was Prescott Bush, Bush's daddy, W's granddaddy. Congratulations, John Brink, Seattle, Washington. Well done. Let's check out right now what's going on, how it's going with the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight and to die. And there are lives in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the cannon. And there is blood on the wire.
Following our security incidents and other developments in Iraq, reported on Wednesday, 0800 GMT by Reuters. Dateline Baghdad, a total of 35 bodies were found in the last 24 hours in Baghdad, police said. Also in Baghdad, a U.S. soldier was killed when his vehicle was struck by a roadside bomb explosion in the northwest part of that city. In Mosul, a U.S. soldier was killed and two were wounded when their vehicle was struck by a suicide car bomber. In Baghdad, a suicide truck bomb blew up his explosives near a police checkpoint in the southern Dora district of that city, killing three police commandos and wounding 11, including three civilians. In Dinwania, one civilian was killed when a roadside bomb went off, placed on one side of the road south of Baghdad. Near Numanaya, a roadside bomb placed on one side of the road exploded near that city, wounding 10 civilians as they were passing by. In Baghdad, four people were wounded when a mortar round landed in northeastern Baghdad. In Mahawil, a roadside bomb targeting an Iraqi army patrol exploded in that city. And in other developments, Saddam Hussein's genocide trial resumed in chaos after the sacking of the chief judge, with the new judge throwing the former Iraqi leader out of the courtroom and the defense team walking out in protest. You may recall the old judge, day before yesterday, said, Saddam, we know you were not a dictator. Well, that was enough to cause the whoever it was. I don't know if it was Maliki or if it was, our ambassador. Who knows? Somebody said, okay, that's it. That judge is out of there. So they brought in a new judge, and so Saddam points to the new judge and says, your daddy used to work for me in the secret police. And all of a sudden, you know, the courtroom goes, and then they grab him and they throw him out. So anyhow, that's strange times in Iraq. No, it's not funny. It's really tragic. It's really and truly tragic. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Craig in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Craig, thanks for calling. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to call and talk to you a little bit about the nuclear you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
And then one other thing, if I have a moment. On The Nation this last weekend on the Laura Flanders show.
Mm-hmm.
She had a doctor, I think she's from Australia, and I think you may have interviewed her before.
Yeah, Helen Caldicott.
Yeah, who wrote the book, Nuclear is Not the Answer.
Right. Helen was my source of the, it takes 19 years before a nuclear power plant produces its first kilowatt of actual electricity that's not oil generated.
Well, the other thing that she brought up was the fact that they're now talking about these fourth generation that are much more efficient and blah, blah, blah. And then she also brought up the fact that they run on plutonium as opposed to uranium, and the substances they create are so toxic that the one molecule of this stuff, if it gets in you, it takes probably about 15 years, but the likelihood
will cause cancer.
Cancer.
Yeah,
it's
one,
just amazing.
Yeah, one ounce.
One more thing,
one,
if I get a chance.
Sure, 1 ounce of plutonium, if properly distributed, is enough to kill every human being on Earth.
Yeah,
and this stuff has been made by the ton.
Yeah, I mean, yes, and that's the, I mean, it's just amazing that people can't go. So if anybody at any time who wants to commit harm to other human beings gets a hold of this stuff, the possibility of the damage they could do is just so phenomenal.
Yeah, and we're going to turn to this for electricity, and it requires huge government subsidies. I mean, it's impossible for a nuclear power plant to operate in the so-called free market because we have to, what was it, the Price-Anderson Act, I think it was. I may be wrong, but there was a bill that was passed that basically says that we, the people, will provide insurance to the nuclear power industry because the insurance industry looked at the nuclear power industry and said, no way, we're going to insure these guys. There's too much risk here. And if there's too much risk for the insurance industry, you know, shouldn't we just be saying, maybe we shouldn't do this?
I'd much rather insure the people on a floodplain, but that's a different story.
Yeah. You had one other point, Craig.
The other point that I wanted to bring up is when you talk to so many of these Democratic people who are running,
mm-hmm.
why we don't bring up the fact of, and you were the one that brought this up to me recently, is why we do not bring up the fact, while the Republicans have been in power, what legislation have they brought forth for the working people, and then what legislation have the Democrats, when they were in power, brought forth for the working people? If they could just bring up that simple fact of, you know,
oh, the Democrats
and all those things.
Yeah, well said, Craig. The Democrats, you know, it's their record on labor and on the working class is well documented. We ran a contest 3 years ago on this program. Tom Tancredo was on, the Republican congressman from Colorado, and I asked him right up front. I said, Congressman Tancredo, can you name one piece of legislation in the 2 years since the Republicans took control of the House, the Senate, and the White House, one piece of legislation that was initiated by Republicans, passed by Republicans, and that inured more benefit to the average American than it did to a corporation? And he was stumped. The only thing he could come up with was some anti-abortion thing, you know, and I said, no, I'm sorry, that doesn't qualify. That doesn't benefit anybody. And he was stumped. And we ran a contest for a year and a half. We finally petered out, I guess. You know, it's that nobody was able to come up with it. With a piece of legislation that the Republicans have come up with, which has as its primary beneficiary the American people. I don't know, maybe you have an idea, let us know. By the way, strange goings on at the North Pole, and George Allen dancing away from his Jewish heritage after the break. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it was John Kennedy who said we should never be afraid to negotiate. We should never negotiate out of fear, and we should never be afraid to negotiate. Now, George W. Bush is not going to negotiate out of fear because he is afraid to negotiate. But he's pretending to negotiate right with the people of the Middle East, or so suggests Jeffrey Feldman, the editor-in-chief at FrameShopIsOpen.com, one of America's leading framers. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Tom.
Welcome to the program. Great to have you with us again. Tell us about this Talk as Strength frame that you are heading up FrameShopIsOpen.com with today.
Well, like everybody else, I was really curious to see what Bush was going to say when he stood up in front of the United Nations. And beyond all this theme that he has, that he's defending civilization, which itself is a problem, the big thing that leapt out at me from the speech was the way that he spoke, as he put it, directly to the people of the Middle East. And he emphasized this over and over again, saying he was speaking to the people of Iraq, to the people of Afghanistan, Lebanon, Iran, and every single nation. It really struck me, particularly since the president of Iran was also in the same in the building on the exact same day, that this gesture, this idea that he was going to speak directly to the people, was really his way of avoiding speaking to the person who was elected, who's in charge of doing diplomatic relations. And I just wanted to push this idea that when Bush talks about speaking to the people, it's really a move of weakness rather than strength, that the real strength in American diplomacy, and it's been this way for generations, not just with Democrats, but also with Republicans, is to sit down with leaders of these nations, even if they stand in strong opposition to the United States, and talk to them, even if it's just symbolic. So I pulled together in this post pictures of American presidents in the past who have sat down and spoken to these opposing world leaders, Kennedy with Khrushchev, Reagan with Gorbachev, and even a picture of Nixon speaking to Chairman Mao, showing that that's an image of diplomatic strength, whereas what we saw from our president yesterday was really a gesture of weakness.
Well, the one time he spoke to the people of Iraq, you'll recall, just before he, as he was announcing that he was going to start bombing them, he said, now I want to speak to the people of Iraq. And we were all expecting some, you know, high words, you know, about, you know, lay down your arms, you know, your young soldiers are the same as our young soldiers, and we all value our families, and nobody wants to see them die, and something like that, you know. But instead, he said, now I'd like to speak to the people of Iraq. And then he said,
your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And the whole world went, oh, now we get it. So anyway, that's a good observation. That's a good one. Other frames or other things that you noticed in his speech?
Well, there's this way that he keeps on ratcheting up what it is that we're fighting for. And the latest concept, that the word that's just been leaping off the page, is this word civilization. What the president is trying to do, once again, is really make this about a battle between barbarians and the civilized world. And remarkably, this is a 19th century theme, you know, where you have three different delineations in the world. You have savages, barbarians, and the civilized. This was a type of hierarchy that was used during the Victorian age. And the idea that the President of the United States would stand up and speak on behalf of civilization at the same time that he was calling for our Senate to rewrite the Geneva Conventions that are in some attempt to prevent what we would call barbaric behavior in situations of war is really quite remarkable. But that's what's leaping off the page.
Yeah, not just remarkable, it's ironic. It's also interesting to note that the 19th century had, as you say, these three frames of Aboriginal indigenous people as savages, the Genghis Khans of the world as barbarians, and us as or Western civilization as civilized. There was also the meme during that time of empire as good. And we've got cons and neocons now trying to resurrect the word empire and associate it with the United States in a favorable context.
It's remarkable. One thing, an alternative to this, I was listening to Jim Webb, who's running for Senate in Virginia, a Democrat running for Senate.
And
he was
against George Allen.
Against George Allen on Meet the Press, and he invoked Eisenhower's words during, you know, the way what Eisenhower was saying during the Korean War and even late in his career. And if you listen, for example, to what Eisenhower was saying in his farewell address, the very famous speech where he used the phrase the military-industrial complex, Eisenhower makes the claim that a good American foreign policy is based on the premise that even the weakest are invited to come to the table and talk as equals. It's really quite an amazing point. And it seems that, at least in this administration, the idea that good diplomacy, that American strength, depends on having everybody in the room sit down at the table and talk, has been completely lost. And this category of, you know, civilized versus the non-civilized is just one way of exacerbating this really flawed approach to what it means for Americans to lead in the world.
Yeah, it really and truly is. And Eisenhower was unambiguous and quite explicit about, you know, his concern about the military-industrial complex and all these kinds of, I mean, Eisenhower probably was the last, well, not the last, Lyndon Johnson as well and Jimmy Carter, but he was, in many regards, one of the most liberal of our presidents in the 20th century. In fact, here's a little clip from him.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
And then he talked about peace. I mean, this is incredible. Dwight, isn't it?
May we be ever unswerving in devotion to principle, confident but humble with power, diligent in pursuit of the nation's great goals. To all the peoples of the world, I once more give expression to America's prayerful and continuing aspiration. We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations, may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings. Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, and that the scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made disappear from the earth. And that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love.
I mean, there's a Republican president talking about the binding force of mutual respect and love. How different from the way George W. Bush talks.
It's incredible, isn't it? I mean, that speech from Eisenhower, one of my favorite speeches, it really is the voice of a senior statesman at the helm of the American government. And when you think that Eisenhower gave that, just a week before he gave up the helm of the presidency, can you imagine George W. Bush making a speech of that caliber 2 years from now as he's ready to leave the White House? It's just unthinkable that the current president would have that level of insight. And a great theme in that Eisenhower speech is the idea that leadership is based on good common sense, which seeks balance, the word that Eisenhower uses over and over again in that speech. And Bush, in everything that he does in foreign policy, really strives for the opposite. He strives for imbalance. The only time we can ever imagine that our president would sit down with a world leader is when his minions behind the scenes have already made sure that Bush has the absolute upper hand, so that when he gets on the world stage with a foreign leader, if he ever does it, it's only to confirm that he is already superior. But the notion, the very basic notion of a handshake between equals, is something that's anathema to our current leader, which is really, really amazing. Now, that Eisenhower speech, there's so many great lessons in it.
Mm. And in a way, your characterization of George W. Bush reminds me of of his history as essentially a spoiled rich frat boy, and the insecurity, I suspect, that would come out of that.
Absolutely. The big fear that Bush has, and I think that his handlers have it as well, is being in a one-on-one conversation between equals. The idea, I mean, not to say that the president of Iran is a person without character flaws at all, hasn't made mistakes, certainly he does, but his strategy vis-a-vis Bush has been to invite him over and over again into a conversation, as even though that's also a PR scheme that the Iranian government is running. Nonetheless, what we get from our president is signs that he really is afraid of that encounter, that he is unwilling to sit down in that moment because he's worried that he won't be able to demonstrate that he is an equal. And so he avoids any and all situations in which he has to go head-on-head, one-on-one, with another leader of that caliber. And the last time I can remember that is really the debates when he was forced to do it with Kerry and
with a receiver in his ear,
exactly, slump on his back.
Yeah, and we go back to this whole war on terror. You're talking about his radio address, the sales pitch basically about a war on a tactic.
I mean
this is weak.
It's incredibly weak. I mean what I write about in that, calling that a pitch, if you just think about what other places you hear that phrase war on with something at the end of it. It's really, it's selling underarm deodorant. They're selling toothpaste that we use that kind of pitch.
Yeah, the war on facial hair.
Exactly. I mean, war on clutter.
Historically it's been like the war on poverty, the war on crime as well, but still, everybody understood that it was just a rhetorical flourish.
Exactly.
Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com, his website. Check it out. Jeffrey, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
The latest news has struck me funny. It's all about greed, boys, and it's all about money. Well, this great nation is in distress. I've got to get something off of my chest. November's coming and it won't be long. When you cast your vote, please don't vote wrong. Vote away those blues, Republican blues.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman Radio Program, where reason prevails. Craig Gorman on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, their website. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Tom. I don't know really what you're going to say about this, but I have to just quote Hugo Chavez. I have to.
Go for it.
So the devil came to the UN yesterday. It still smells of sulfur here. I have the feeling you're going to live out the rest of your days in a nightmare. We need a psychologist to analyze Bush. He called he called the president the devil, pretty much.
Yeah, well, not pretty much. He did explicitly.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. Not pretty much. He called the president the devil.
I'm curious, Greg. You know, yeah. I know when Bush was speaking, the audience was, you know, there was no applause. Kofi Annan spoke before George did, and he got a standing ovation. Bush did not. I mean, it was a very, very a reserved audience. What was the response to Chavez when he said that?
Well, see, that's what's interesting. I'm actually in New York City now because we're doing a big radio row tomorrow. I didn't even get to hear the speech. So I'm actually more excited about seeing the clips of the speech because I've seen Chavez speak in person when I used to work in Venezuela. I've seen how fiery he is. I've seen, you know, his histrionics. I bet it was a fascinating display.
Yeah, a barn burner.
I've already heard today that it's being compared, you know, to when Khrushchev came and took a shoe off and slammed it down on the podium. It's that kind of speech. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be remembered as a moment at the United Nations.
Interesting. Although Khrushchev was actually sitting when he did that, he wasn't. He was. That was in the Security Council, as I recall.
Oh, was
but
he?
Nonetheless, it's amazing that Chavez would say that. And yesterday, Ahmadinejad's comments were really rather conciliatory, particularly in the contrast to Chavez. I mean, Ahmadinejad was saying, we're in favor of peace. We're calling on all nations of the world to lay down nuclear weapons. Let's completely disarm the entire planet. Let's put forward, you know, let's bring back the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty that George Bush has walked away from. The country of Iran says that it's against our religion to have nuclear weapons. We will never build nuclear weapons. We will allow the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency of the United Nations, to inspect and monitor all of our nuclear developments. I mean, that was a very conciliatory speech in many ways. Although the thing that gave me the creeps about it, and I read the entire speech this morning, was his constant reference to religion. I mean, Ahmadinejad is as much of a fundamentalist as is George W. Bush, and wears it much more on his sleeve.
Oh, absolutely. You know,
when religion gets dragged into politics like this.
You know, as you probably heard, that's why he didn't.
Still there with us, Greg? We have lost Greg Gorman. He's vanished. Oh, well. Anyhow, that's the point. I thought an interesting point for the day, and we'll see how it shakes out, and we'll see if Greg gets back with us. UN, Ahmadinejad, is Bush the devil? No, somehow I don't think so. I mentioned before the break, George Allen. The news came out. It was revealed that George Allen's grandfather was Jewish, and you know, for the average politician, that would not mean a great deal. I mean, add a few percent of the American population to your constituency, I guess. But from a guy who, as the governor, had a lynching noose in his office and a Confederate flag on the wall and likes to be photographed with and hang out with white power racist advocates, this has become a problem for George Allen. So yesterday, he gave a speech in which he said, I still had a ham sandwich for lunch, and my mother made great pork chops. Mm-hmm. Isn't that, I mean, this is just, like, weird that Senator George Allen is, like, going out of his way to say, well, okay, so the press has found out that there's some Jewish blood in there, but I'm eating pork chops. I mean, it's just weird. I don't know how else to describe it. And European scientists have voiced shock. No, not about George Allen. Although George Allen's involved in this, he's one of the Republicans who are, you know, essentially stalling, who, you know, prevented Kyoto and stalling any action on global warming. European scientists voicing shock today as they were showed pictures which demonstrate, which showed the Arctic ice cover has disappeared so much last month that a ship could sail unhindered from Europe to the North Pole. This has never happened before. This has got them absolutely, totally, totally spooked. And the rest of us should be as well, because what we're entering into now is a positive feedback loop, and that's not a good thing. Where when it gets a little warmer, it stimulates the systems that make it even warmer, like the melting of the permafrost, or the melting of methane crystals in the sea floor that that could create the soda pop effect, and all of a sudden everything is bubbling, could be an absolute disaster. So we'll see how this all shakes out. I think that we should be in a break right now. Maybe I've lost my stream.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Shake it up. Shake it up. Shake it up. Shake it up.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place for tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Yes, 20,000 troops injured, a benchmark. The rate at which U.S. troops are being killed continued to slowly fall, but the rate at which injuries were suffered, including serious ones, continued to rise in Iraq. This is from Martin Seif, UPI senior news analyst. The rate at which U.S. soldiers are being injured in Iraq continued to slowly but inexorably rise. From September 1 to September 18, 340 U.S. soldiers were injured in Iraq at an average rate of 18.9 per day. Amazing. Well, not amazing. Tragic. I mean, this is really, really and truly tragic. And how about an activism alert? Let's you know, what can you do if you want to do something and you're not sure what to do? Here's something you can do.
May take all we down and may take long out. They got the guns, but we got the numbers. Gonna win, yeah, we're taking over. Come on!
Yeah, over at MoveOn.org, they note, this week the Senate is planning to quietly hold a vote that would pardon President Bush for breaking the law by illegally wiretapping innocent Americans without warrants. According to Senator Pat Leahy, the bill would, quote, immunize officials who have violated federal law by authorizing such illegal activities, end quote. George W. Bush broke the law. He broke a law that has a 5 years in prison penalty. And the Republicans are pushing as hard as they can to change that law before the elections, when Democrats might conceivably be able to actually hold a hearing. Keep in mind, right now, Democrats do not have the power in either the House or the Senate to use a subpoena and to compel testimony. They cannot call a hearing. The Republicans, in the past, when the Democrats controlled both the House and the Senate, they let Republicans hold hearings and use subpoena power. This is the first time this has happened since the founding of this nation, but for the last 5 years, the Republicans have forbidden the Democrats from investigating anything that the Republicans are doing. I mean, even when Harry Truman, the Democratic senator from Missouri, stood up to Democratic President Franklin Roosevelt, and the Democrats held both the House and the Senate in 1944 and stood up and said, I'm going to investigate whether there are war profiteers, it was 43, whether there are war profiteers among the corporations supplying our military. The Democratic president said, go ahead, do it. Not to mention, you know, a lot of Republicans participating in this. Republicans were holding hearings all the time. No, not happening now. This is the Cheney-Specter bill. It allows President Bush and every president after him to wiretap Americans indefinitely, in secret, without a warrant, and without any oversight. Effectively pardons the president for illegal behavior by forcing Congress to concede that he had the inherent authority to conduct the program, something federal courts and numerous legal experts and many leading Republicans disagree with. Completely guts FISA. Prevents any legal challenge from taking place in the court system. Immunizes officials who broke the law. So you can sign the petition over at MoveOn.org, or you can call your member of Congress at 1-888-355-3588, toll free, 1-888-355-3588, and just say, enough already. We want some accountability. Do not change the FISA law. Do not let George Bush off the hook. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Ron in Bennington, Vermont. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Hello, yeah, how are you today, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Ron. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm calling about Mr. Chavez's comments. I applaud him for saying it. I mean, it took great courage to stand up against the leader of the empire. And, of course, George Bush isn't the actual devil, but symbolically, the wickedness and he's caused so much pain and suffering and death around the globe that he could be considered the devil symbolically.
Well, in some regards. I mean, he's certainly the deaths of over 100,000 people, the blood of over 100,000 people is on his hands right now. This war in Iraq that he did just to gain political power and you know, maybe so Cheney's buddies could get rich. But, I'm not sure that makes him a devil. But Chavez is good with a rhetorical flourish, and he certainly made his point. Thanks, Ron, for the call. Max in Pittsburgh, you see the other side of this.
Well, it appears to me that Hugo Chavez used to be one of my heroes, but then he went to Tehran and stood with Ahmadinejad and called for the obliteration of Israel. I didn't know that Chavez was such an anti-Semite.
Yeah, I didn't either, and I don't know that to this moment, although if that's the case... He actually Chavez himself called for the end of Israel. I don't.
He went to Tehran to meet with Ahmadinejad.
No, but that doing that is different than calling for
the end of
Israel.
Speech together, they both called for the obliteration of Israel.
Wow. Yeah, if that's the case, Max, that's sad news to hear.
And one other question, which is frivolous: why hasn't someone pursued the hooker thing with the White House?
Which particular one?
The guy who went there 150 times.
Oh, because the Democrats don't have the power of the subpoena.
Right.
I mean, when Bill Clinton fired a travel agent, they spent over $1 million investigating it, thinking that maybe, you know, he'd had an affair with her or something. I mean, you know,
I remember
Travelgate?
I remember
that
garbage.
Everything. You know, Hillary Clinton loses a file from her law firm from 26 years earlier, and, oh, this is a scandal. We can't find the files. I mean, it's a Filegate. And I mean, because the Republicans controlled the House of Representatives, so they had the power of subpoena. They could hold committee hearings, and they could subpoena witnesses.
We live in a dictatorship.
Well, we're moving in that direction, and you know, thus the tragedy. I mean, that's the real concern. And in fact, a perfect segue, Max. Let me just share with you Benito Mussolini in 1932, with the help of Giovanni Gentile, who actually wrote this, but it had Mussolini's name attached to it. The Italian Encyclopedia, the definition of fascism. Fascism, wrote Mussolini, the more, and Gentile, fascism, the more it considers and observes the future and the development of humanity, quite apart from political considerations at the moment, believes neither in the possibility nor the utility of perpetual peace. It thus repudiates the doctrine of pacifism, born of a renunciation of the struggle and an act of cowardice in the face of sacrifice. War alone brings up to its highest tension all human energy, and puts the stamp of nobility upon the peoples who have the courage to meet it. All other trials are substitutes, which never really put men into the position where they make the great decision, the alternative of life or death. This is the dictionary, this is the Italian Encyclopedia of 1932, Mussolini talking about fascism. After socialism, fascism combats the whole complex system of democratic ideology and repudiates it. Whether in its theoretical premises or its practical application, fascism denies that the majority, by the simple fact that it is a majority, can direct human society. It denies that numbers alone can govern by means of a periodical consultation. And it affirms the immutable, beneficial, and fruitful inequality of mankind, which can never be permanently leveled through the mere operation of a mechanical process such as universal suffrage. In other words, everybody being allowed to vote. This is about the time that Mussolini dissolved Parliament and replaced it with the Chamber of the Fascist Corporations, Cameo de Fascio Corporationes. The fascist state organizes the nation but leaves a sufficient margin of liberty to the individual. The individual is deprived of all useless and possibly harmful freedom, but retains freedom that is essential. The deciding power in this question, however, cannot be the individual but the state alone. For fascism, the growth of empire, that is to say, the expansion of the nation, is an essential manifestation of vitality. It is the opposite of a sign of decadence. People who are arising again after a period of decadence are always imperialist, and renunciation is a sign of decay and death. Fascism is the doctrine best adapted to represent the tendencies and aspirations of a people like the people of Italy, who are rising again after many centuries of abasement and foreign servitude. But empire demands discipline, the coordination of all forces, and a deeply felt sense of duty and sacrifice. This fact explains many aspects of the practical working of the regime, the character of many forces in the state, and the necessary severe measures which must be taken against those who would oppose this spontaneous and inevitable movement of Italy in the 20th century, and would oppose it by recalling the outworn ideology of the 19th century, reputed wheresoever there has been the courage to undertake great experiments of social and political transformation. For never before, said Mussolini, never before has the nation stood more in need of authority, of direction, of order. If every age has its own characteristic doctrine, said Mussolini, there are 1,000 signs, 1,000 points of light perhaps, which point to fascism as the characteristic doctrine of our time. For if a doctrine must be a living thing, this is proved by the fact that fascism has created a living faith, and that this faith is very powerful in the minds of men, is demonstrated by those who have suffered and died for it. Fascism, Benito Mussolini. Yeah, the authoritarian government, the father, the strong father, as George Lakoff points out, George W. Bush. They're dropping the word fascism in association with Islam, officially, although not everybody got the memo. Why? Well, I guess it blew back on him. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now there are rumors in the camp about our enemy. They say that when you see him, he looks just like you and me. But you deny it, Sergeant, and you are a man of war. So you must give me lessons, for I've never killed before.
And welcome back. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting for a Change. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Matt in Sacramento, California, says here, you disagree with me, so you go to the front of the line. What's up?
Oh, yeah, because you remember back when the NAFTA thing was going on and there was an election coming up and the Democrats and Republicans both agreed not to use it as a campaign issue?
Yeah.
Well, here we are again. They've used the term Islamo-fascism. And now maybe I misunderstood what you were saying, but the way it sounded was, now that the White House has dropped it, we're never going to mention it again that they used it?
No, no, that's not what I was saying.
Oh, good. Yeah. Because
we need to point out that they were using it. No,
we've got to beat them over the head with it. This is a horrible thing they did.
I agree. Okay, good.
That was my comment.
Thanks a lot.
God bless. Bye.
You too. Good to hear from you. Okay, now here's what happened. Bush, you know, the neocons have been pushing for this Islamo-fascist phrase for a long time. And, you know, the Bill Kristol bunch and the Leo Strauss followers and the hangers-on. And finally Bush worked it into a speech a couple of weeks ago. And there was so much blowback from the Islamic world that Condi Rice had to sit him down and say, you know, you're blowing us up here. I mean, you're doing more harm than good. And so the White House has decided that they're not going to use the word Islamo-fascist anymore. And... But I'm not saying that the Democrats shouldn't point out that the Republicans were, you know, enthusiastically and gleefully using this word that, to the Muslim world, is viewed as an anti-Semitic slur. No, it's not anti-Jewish, an anti-Muslim slur. If there is a word similar to anti-Semitic to describe a slur against Muslims, I don't know what the word is, but it's viewed as a slur. And they didn't want that happening. Ed in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Ed.
Hi there. Well, you're doing great and getting better.
Well, thank you.
And I'd like to talk about a million things, but I'll try to keep it down to one or two. One thing is that when often when you're mentioning Prescott Bush and his involvement with the Nazi financing and such,
yeah,
I think you're kind of misunderestimating his involvement in that he was a major player in the Harriman Brothers.
Yeah, he was on the board of the bank, actually.
Yes, he was, and he got plenty of money for this, too.
Yep.
And they were one of the major financiers of the Nazi regime through Fritz Thyssen, selling war bonds through their bank to the American people.
Right, prior to our entry into the war.
Correct.
But after
prior to his rise in power. In other right. words, they helped put him into the power that we had to go to war against.
Him being Hitler, yes.
Yes. And yes, and that this little Skull and Bones clique then got put out of business temporarily, but because for trading with the enemy
by Franklin Roosevelt, right? And yeah. And the story that I've heard, and I heard this from Gloria Swanson, who used to date Joe Kennedy, and was that basically the Bush family swore that the Bushes and the Kennedys were like competing, and there was this blood oath of hatred against the Roosevelts.
That's so interesting because I consider that the Skull and Bones clique end of it actually succeeded with a successful coup in 1963,
yeah.
and have then weaseled themselves up into power. Now you got to consider that Stimson, the Skull and Bones, pushed Truman to use the nuclear bomb. Of course, the Harriman brothers and their whole association with the Dulleses,
mm-hmm.
McGeorge Bundy, Skull and Bones, the 11 members of Bush's.
I know what you're talking about, Ed,
and it's a
rabbit hole you can go down and get lost in because the history of Skull and Bones is absolutely
wild.
Well,
but it shows their nature. The thing is that it shows their nature. What are these people like? Why do they have Geronimo's skull and femurs in their Skull and Bones temple at Yale?
Yeah.
And that new evidence has come out this year that shows that at least they thought in 1918 that they had them, and they were dug up by Prescott Bush.
Yeah, and he's the one who brought him in there. Good point. Ed, thank you for calling and making it. 1-866-440-8466. Elizabeth in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hi. Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I love your show, and I just discovered it not too long ago, so I'm thrilled to have you on the radio. I listened to Michael Ratner yesterday.
Center for Constitutional...
Constitutional Rights.
Right. That's right.
Talking, and I was simply shocked that what he said that I haven't heard anywhere else, and that's this. The controversy between the president and his Republicans in the Senate over the Geneva Conventions has not mentioned this, and that is both bills, both the president's proposal and the Senate proposal, supposedly so good for justice, the Senate proposal and the Bush, both of them do away with habeas corpus for prisoners, for anybody, anybody.
Terrorist suspects in quotes, which means anybody that the president says is a terrorist suspect. You're absolutely right, Elizabeth.
That's right.
And it's a horrible thing.
You know, this is based on the Magna Carta.
That's
right.
I was going to say.
13th century.
That's right. And, 1215, in the field of Runnymede, King John was confronted by the feudal lords, and they said, "We're not going to take this anymore. And we want an absolute writ of habeas corpus, the right to know that if we are arrested, there is a reason and what we are charged with, and to face our accuser to have due process of law." And then in the 1500s, 1516 or 1617, in any case, there was a second and third actual habeas corpus acts passed during the reign of King James, as I recall. So it must have been around 1615. And it's been part of the law ever since. I mean, literally since the year 1215. And George W. Bush wants to do away with habeas corpus. It's mind-boggling. Michael Ratner will be on our program on Friday, by the way. We'll be back right after the news. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. The Senate bill we were talking about is Senate Bill 2453. Just as a heads up, and apparently the toll-free number to Congress has been disconnected. Gee, what a surprise. Republicans in charge, no more toll-free number. You want to call Congress, the telephone number, the direct phone number for Congress, you'll have to pay for the call, is on our homepage at tomhartman.com. It's 202-225-3121. You can reach any member of the House or Senate at that number. 202-225-3121. I know a lot of people have unlimited minutes on their cell phone, or a fair chunk of them, or they've got a Vonage or whatever, you know, voice over IP or something. So 202-225-3121, and we'll be looking around for other toll-free numbers, but right now, that's it. And thanks to Lauren at Air America New York for and the callers who have called in and shared that information with her for sharing it with me. There's a confluence of stories here. Three seemingly separate stories that I'd like to tie together for you. The first is a survey about MBA students, Masters of Business Administration, MBA students. When you look at graduate school students right across the board, the ones most likely to cheat in school are those working for their MBAs. Nobody knows why, but the survey of this, a survey of 5,331 students at 32 graduate schools in the United States and Canada found an alarming amount of cheating across disciplines, but more among the nation's future business leaders. 56% of graduate business students admitted they had cheated at least once in the last year, and then you wonder about the other 44% if they're cheating about whether or not they cheated. This is a survey that ran for 2 years, 2002 to 2004, done by Pennsylvania State, Rutgers, and Washington State Universities. Why business students would cheat more than others is a matter of conjecture. One researcher said it might be that the students who were drawn to business school were more self-interested or bottom-line oriented. In other words, the ends justify the means. Some studies also suggest that business school, with its emphasis on the free market and the maximization of shareholder value, changes students' attitudes. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, the Senate approves a free trade pact with Oman. This one from the Associated Press out of today's Wall Street Journal. Congress gave final approval Tuesday to a free trade agreement with Oman. Well, what does this mean? It means that we're going to end all duties on products that Oman wants to sell to us. Now, on the other hand, Oman has 10 years to remove duties on 87% of U.S. agricultural imports and eliminate all tariffs within 10 years. So, you know, once again, we're giving multinational corporations and the buddies of the administration a good deal. And then the third story, Republicans maintain, this from today by Jeannie Cummings in today's Washington or Wall Street Journal, Republicans maintain a strong fundraising advantage that they could play a pivotal role in close races. Republican National Committee has more than three times the cash of the DNC, $39 million in the bank. RNC Chairman Ken Melman has promised to use that money to bombard the airwaves with negative advertisements aimed at, I'm reading from the Wall Street Journal here, with negative advertisements aimed at Democrats and to run a high-tech get-out-the-vote operation that will overwhelm their opponents' operations. And I predict there's a good chance that it'll actually be the case. Well, Harry Truman talked about this back in 1959 when he was president of the United States, March 29th. Talking about the Republicans and tax cuts for the rich and all these policies. And you just get the difference in the understanding that Americans had back in the 1950s from the understanding that Americans have right now of the difference between the parties and the role of government. Here's Harry Truman.
Now I want to say something very important to you about this issue of morality in government.
And you remember, we were talking about the MBA students and cheating, and now we're talking about Abramoff and cheating and the morality in government.
It is just as immoral to use the lawmaking power of the government to enrich the few at the expense of the many as it is to steal money from the public treasury. That is stealing money from the public treasury.
Then he mentions Teapot Dome. This was a scandal where during the Harding administration, Albert Fell, the Secretary of the Interior, gave an oil lease or a gas lease to a friend of his. $300,000 profit was what was made. It nearly brought down the Harding administration. Huge scandal. $300,000 bucks. I mean, $8 billion missing in Iraq right now, $300,000.
Legislation that favored the greed of monopoly and the trickery of Wall Street was a form of corruption that did the country four times as much harm as Teapot Dome ever did.
This is Harry Truman, who investigated war profiteering during World War II, you'll recall.
Private, selfish interests are always trying to corrupt the government in this way. Powerful financial groups are always trying to get favors for themselves.
And the Republicans have institutionalized it. Ricky Santorum every week, his K-State Project breakfasts.
Now, the Democratic administration has been fighting against these efforts to corrupt the powers of government. We haven't always won, but we have never surrendered, and we never will.
President Harry Truman.
For all these years, we've been fighting to use our natural resources for the benefit of the public.
Oh, the idea of the commons, that there's stuff we own in common collectively, we the people.
To develop our forests and our public oil reserves and our water power for the benefit of all. To raise the incomes of all our citizens. To protect the farmer and the worker against the power of monopoly.
Against the power of monopoly. When was the last time you heard a president of the United States talk about monopoly? Not since Ronald Reagan have I heard a single president talk about the danger of monopoly. And yet here's Harry Truman in 1952 going on about it. The danger of corporations agglomerating themselves into giant monopolies.
And where have the Republicans been in this fight for morality in government? Do they come out and vote with us to keep the special interests from robbing the public? Not at all. Most of them are on the other side. Same thing when you come to the question of the conduct of government officials. The Republicans make a great whoop and holler about the honesty of federal employees. But they are usually the first to show up in a government office asking for special favors for private interests and in raising Cain if they don't get them.
And you've certainly seen this played out in the modern times.
These Republican gentlemen can't have it both ways. They can't be for morality on Tuesday and Thursday, and then be for special privileges for their clients on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Well, I don't think the black is white campaign of the Republican Party is going to succeed. I think the voters are going to see through this holier-than-thou disguise that our Republican friends are putting on. All the tricks of Republican propaganda cannot make the people forget that the Democratic Party has been working for their welfare.
There you go. President Harry Truman, reporter once said, Harry, the Republicans say you're giving them hell. And he said, I don't give them hell. I just tell the truth and they think it's hell. Speaking of telling the truth, John F. Kennedy, one of the big lies, one of the big cons of the Republicans has been that, you know, Kennedy dropped the top tax rate from 90% to 70%, and that produced an increase in net wealth in the United States, in income taxes, excuse me. The income tax revenues went up. Well, the truth is, yes, Kennedy reduced the margin at the top rate from 90 to 70%, but he closed so many loopholes, and that's what he was talking about. He says, we're going to close all these loopholes, so we'll actually be taxing the rich more. They will be paying more taxes. Here's Jack Kennedy in 1960 during the second debate with Richard Nixon talking about this.
Yes, I have stated in both debates, and state again, that I believe in a balanced budget and have supported that concept during my 14 years in the Congress. The only two times when an unbalanced budget is warranted would be during a serious recession, and we had that in 58 in an unbalanced budget of $12 billion, or a national emergency where there should be large expenditures for national defense, which we have in World War II and during part of the Korean War.
And then he gets into, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to close up these loopholes.
Third, I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
Notice he didn't say tax cuts. He said tax changes. This was actually a tax increase by Jack Kennedy, although the Republicans have completely respun it. And as he points out, they lied about it then, they're lying about it now.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education, we'd spend more money on housing, we'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. But I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly.
Ah, Mr. Nixon misstates my figures, and they still are, Jack.
Which is, of course, is right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
Okay, so it's on the public record. The Jack Kennedy, yes, he reduced the top marginal rate from 90 to 70% for the very richest Americans on their highest levels of income, on what today would be tens of millions of dollars of income. But he also closed up the loopholes. And that's, you know, this is where Reaganomics falls apart. You know, Reagan said, okay, we're going to drop it from 70% down to 27%. That'll actually increase revenue, won't it? No, it didn't. It threw the country into so much debt that we have become the largest debtor nation in the world as a result of the tax changes that Reagan initiated and that Bush and Bush have perpetuated. It's been a disaster. And in part, they sold it by lying about Kennedy's position. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Well, you can't turn him into a company man. You can't turn him into a horse. And the boys upstairs just don't understand anymore. Well, the top brass don't like him talking so much. And he won't play what they say to play. And he don't want to change. What don't need to change? And there goes the last DJ, who plays what he wants to play, and says what he wants to say.
And welcome back to the radio support group, up by and for We the People of the United States of America, run by this old DJ, Tom Hartman, here with you. Larry Scott on the line. He's the editor-in-chief, chief cook and bottle washer over at VAWatchdog.org, a website of the same name. Hey, Larry.
Good morning or afternoon, wherever you happen to be, John.
Yes, indeed. Fine day to you, Larry.
That too.
This is not your father's VFW. The VFW is trying to reinvent itself?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it is. The Veterans of Foreign Wars, the VFW, there's a big turmoil going on inside the organization. The VFW is the nation's second largest veteran service organization with well over a million members. And they have a new reform-minded national commander. The gentleman's name is Gary Kirpius, and he has just raised all kinds of concerns inside the VFW.
Just a quick question here. Before my grandfather was in the DAV, the Disabled American Vets.
Right.
And my father was in the VFW. Is the DAV part of the VFW, or are these separate organizations?
No, they're all separate. You have the American Legion, which is the largest service organization, and then just behind that is the VFW, and then the DAV, the Disabled American Veterans, is the third largest, and they all have a little bit different membership standards as to when you served. And, of course, in the Disabled American Veterans, you do have to be a service-connected disabled veteran to join that, where in the other two organizations, you do not have to be a disabled veteran.
Okay.
All you have to be is a veteran who served during a time of conflict.
So to be in the VFW, did you have to serve during time of conflict or in the conflict?
No, just during time of conflict.
Okay.
And the organizations determine different conflicts, which is kind of confusing, too. Some of them take the very, very minor conflicts around the globe. Some of them only choose major conflicts, but that's a huge, long story. Yeah. But it also has to do with what's going on here because of the way the membership rules are written, the VFW, the American Legion, are finding themselves with a dwindling membership. Last year, the VFW closed or consolidated more than 148 posts, or what we call clubhouses, around the country. They didn't have the members. They didn't have the money to support them. So the new command.
Why is that?
Well, the members are getting older. We're not making as many veterans. And the new veterans who are coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan just aren't interested.
I see. They view the VFW as an old boys club.
It is their father's VFW, and they're not interested. And now Commander Kirpius wants to change the VFW. He said, you know, some of us are stuck in the 60s and 70s. We have to adapt to a changing world. And what really got them was there has to be something more attractive about the VFW than just the bar.
As in a beer.
As in the liquor serving bar.
Right.
This was met with a lot of moans and groans at their national convention, and then he really took a lot of heat when he was told the Post they should ban smoking, they should get with the program. He said there's no reason to let 20% of the population dictate that we should have smoking in our posts. And he wants the VFW to open up more to the public. He's encouraged them to start cyber cafes, develop child care facilities, even start fitness centers. This is not being met with a lot of enthusiasm in the membership. I took a look around Washington State where I live, and I took a look around a couple of VFW posts. One of them has Stop Smokers. Washington has a no-smoking law anyway in bars and restaurants. One of the VFWs I looked at has banned smoking. They're opening up more to the public. They're having more family nights. They're opening up their restaurant for more public dining. And even though their revenues are slightly down, they feel they're going to be on an upswing as they get more involved in their community. Right. Another one of the posts I looked at, Tom, has gone exactly the other way. They've withdrawn. They've said, we're not going to follow the smoking ban of the state of Washington. They found a loophole to get around it.
Right. Private club loophole.
Right. And the private club loophole. And they're saying, this is just the way we are. This is our bar. We smoke here. And we're going to keep it this way. But the point here is veteran service organizations have to change with the times. There has to be something to draw in the new veteran and to make them feel like they are a part of this, what is now considered a good old boy community. And at this moment, it's just not happening.
Yeah. And traditionally, they've been relatively apolitical, too. Do you see that changing?
For the most part, they have been apolitical. They have always been very, very patriotic, and they have taken public patriotic stances. This is mainly the VFW and the American Legion I'm talking about here. Those public patriotic stances tend to go hand in hand with the Republican Party. And so while they tend to claim political neutrality, we often see Republican candidates and, of course, Republican presidents coming into VFW organizations and into American Legion organizations where you do not see so many Democratic candidates. And it has to do with selling the image, waving the flag and so forth. But again, they're supposed to be non-political.
Interesting story. Of course, there's a lot of real veterans issues. I mean, serious veterans are being screwed right now by the government. You can learn all about it over at VAWatchdog.org. Larry Scott, good talking with you, Larry.
Tom, thank you very much.
Keep up the great work. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Viagra for your brain, but don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
What gives you the right to you to stand there and tell me what to do? Tell me who gave you the power to stop me from living like I do? Remember.
And welcome back to listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman radio program, with no monthly fee, 34 minutes past the hour. Our sponsors, Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. Their telephone number, 1-800-425-2532, and sacredgroundscoffee.com, their website, all organic, all fair trade, and incredibly delicious. I'm drinking Peruvian French roast right now. Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now, and all things Macintosh, all things PC, 1-800-511-MAX, or smalldog.com, the website. And the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECOWINE, or ecowine.com on the Internet. Don Davis over at the satiricalpolitical.com website, which gives you a clue in as to how seriously to take this, but it's, while recent news reports have focused on the problems with spinach infected by E. coli, the World Health Organization has issued an urgent alert warning of the grave dangers posed by an outbreak of Neo coli, a shorthand name for neocon lies and world domination. Unlike E. coli, a foodborne illness which originates on farms, the Neo coli bacteria is considered a skewed-base disease and emanates from chicken hawks, who usually occupy a large White House or pentagonal-shaped building. However, what both strains have in common is their core component, manure, also known as Chenibacterius or Bushococcus 43. The Neo coli bacteria is much more dangerous than E. coli, which usually causes only limited fatalities. Neo coli is particularly rampant in the Middle East and causes massive cases of diarrhea, abdominal clamps, and the spread of Shiitis. While E. coli typically affects products like spinach, Neo coli depends for its survival on spin-ish. Also, unlike most products infected with E. coli, which are inadvertently ingested, Neo coli is invariably shoved down the victim's throat. A spokesman for Disease Control also emphasized that while those infected with E. coli can always be treated with antibiotics, there is no similar remedy for Neo coli, which stubbornly stays its course and appears resistant to a body politic's immune system of checks and balances. Well, we can hope. We can hope. Particularly, our joke for the day. A felon, a fundamentalist, and a fascist walks into a bar. The bartender says, "Hello, President Bush." Speaking of President Bush, the Senate Intelligence Committee, chaired by the Republican from Kansas, Senator Pat Roberts, released a report under the signature of the Republican from Kansas examining the links between al-Qaeda and Iraq before George W. Bush invaded and occupied Iraq. And what they concluded was that there was no link between Iraq and al-Qaeda, between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. None. This is actually from the report, authored by the Republicans in the United States Senate. Quote, "Saddam Hussein was distrustful of al-Qaeda and viewed Islamic extremists as a threat to his regime, refusing all requests from al-Qaeda to provide material or operational support." Gee, we've only been saying that for 4 or 5 years now. Saddam issued, again, quoting from the report, the Republican report, "Saddam issued a general order that Iraq should not deal with al-Qaeda. No post-war information suggests that the Iraqi regime attempted to facilitate a relationship with bin Laden." So the Bush administration has taken your and my tax dollars, and over at whitehouse.gov, by the way, whitehouse.org is a much better site. If you want to really know what's going on, go to whitehouse.org. But over at whitehouse.gov, the official White House website, they have put up a page called "The Rest of the Story, Iraq's Links to Al-Qaeda," which essentially says, no, we weren't lying. We were just trusting George Tenet. So, you know, kind of go along. Come on, guys. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Our tax dollars. 1-866-440-8466, our phone number. Jude in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jude, what's on your mind today?
Hey, good morning. I wanted to add what you were mentioning, Tom, about that trade agreement with Oman.
I watched
Senator Conrad Monday on the floor, and if you get a chance to pull it up, it's just an excellent, it's a wonderful piece.
Kent Connor, correct.
He brought up, though, just as equal, about the money, are the human rights violations that are going on. You know, they're getting, you know, just the poor from all over Bangladesh. And when they're getting there, they're taking and holding passports.
Mm-hmm.
They have little or no money they're receiving. It's the same thing that was going on in Dubai.
Yeah, it's essentially slave labor. I mean, most of these emirates are operating as feudal societies. I mean, they are feudal societies, feudal societies. They're like Europe in the Middle Ages.
But what I called about was, and I'll be very succinct, around the first of the year, the Army Corps of Engineers awarded Homeland Security with a contract, and of course Halliburton got it, and the purpose was to start the creation of detention centers here in the States. And they began looking, you can find it on Halliburton concentration or detention centers through Google. But
In fact, they've just completed the construction of the first one down in Texas, haven't they?
Yeah, it's mind-boggling.
What they say they're for, and apparently this first one that's opened in Texas is actually being used for, is detaining illegal aliens who were previously being caught and then released under this catch-and-release program, which, you know, Lou Dobbs was ranting about and got people stirred up enough about that the Bushies decided this is doing us political damage, and so we better do something about it. And so they say, well, what do you do if you want to do something about anything? You call Halliburton.
Yeah. But it was most interesting when it was Homeland Security giving it to Halliburton, because I never cared for this Homeland Security when it was created, and my premise was why, what was the purpose? But now I look, and what have they done in terms of securing? You know, we have Katrina, we have the Dubai ports, you know, the borders. Nothing followed up on 9/11. And my sense is it's just to really maybe secure truth seekers. You know, they talk about being seditious.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, in fact, yes. Jude, thank you for the call. Let me share a little information here with you. February 27th, it started when the government, in the midst of an economic crisis, received reports of an imminent terrorist attack. A foreign ideologue had launched feeble attacks on a few famous buildings, but the media largely ignored his relatively small efforts. The intelligence services knew, however, that the odds were he would eventually succeed. The warnings of investigators were ignored at the highest levels, in part because the government was distracted. The man who claimed to be the nation's leader had not been elected by a majority vote, and the majority of citizens claimed he had no right to the powers he coveted. He was a simpleton, some said, a cartoon character of a man who saw things in black and white terms and didn't have the intellect to understand the subtleties of running a nation in a complex and internationalist world. His coarse use of language, reflecting his political roots in a southernmost state, and his simplistic and often inflammatory nationalist rhetoric offended the aristocrats, foreign leaders, and the well-educated elite in the government and media. As a young man, he joined a secret society with an occult-sounding name and a bizarre initiation ritual that involved skulls and human bones. Nevertheless, he knew that the terrorist was going to strike, although he didn't know where or when, and he had already considered his response. When an aide brought him word that the nation's most prestigious building was on fire, he verified it was the terrorist who had struck, the terrorist who he had been warned was going to strike, and then rushed to the scene and called a press conference. "We are now witnessing the beginning of a great epoch in history," Adolf Hitler proclaimed, standing in front of the burned-out Reichstag-Gebouw parliament building surrounded by national media. "This fire," he said, his voice trembling with emotion, "is the beginning. It is a sign from God." He used it to declare an all-out war on terrorism and its ideological sponsors, the people, he said, who traced their origins to the Middle East and found motivation for their evil deeds in their religion. 2 weeks later, the first detention center for terrorists was built in Oranienburg to hold the first suspected allies of Marius van der Lubbe, the infamous terrorist. In a national outburst of patriotism, the leader's flag was everywhere, even printed large in newspapers suitable for window display. Within 4 weeks of the terrorist attack, the nation's now popular leader had pushed through legislation in the name of combating terrorism and fighting the philosophy he said spawned it, that suspended constitutional guarantees of free speech, privacy, and habeas corpus. Police could now intercept mail, wiretap phones. Suspected terrorists could be imprisoned without specific charges and without access to their lawyers. Police could sneak into people's homes without warrants if the cases involved terrorism. To get his patriotic, quote, decree on the protection of people and state, end quote, passed over the objections of concerned legislators, he put a 4-year sunset provision on it. Immediately after passage of the anti-terrorism attack, his federal police agencies stepped up their program of arresting suspicious persons and holding them without access to lawyers or courts. In the first year, only a few hundred were interred, and those who objected were largely ignored by the mainstream press, which was afraid to offend and thus lose access to a leader with such high popularity ratings. Citizens who protested the leader in public, and there were many, quickly found themselves confronting the newly empowered police's batons, gas, and jail cells, or fenced off in protest zones, safely out of the earshot of the leader's public speeches. 45 minutes past the hour.
bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those mad Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
From your lips to God's ears, Leonard, welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Within the first months after that terrorist attack, at the suggestion of a political advisor, Adolf Hitler, this is just our history lesson for the day, Adolf Hitler brought a formerly obscure word into common usage. He wanted to stir a racial pride among his countrymen. So instead of referring to the nation by its name, or as the fatherland, as it had often been called, he began to refer to it as the homeland, a phrase publicly promoted in the introduction to a 1934 speech by Rudolf Hess. Rudolf Hess said, Dank Ihre Führung, Dank, thank you, Ihren, your Führung, leadership, thanks to your leadership. The homeland is here. Heimat zu sein. The Deutschland will become the Heimat, the homeland, for all the Germans in the world, for alles Deutsche über die ganze Welt, as I recall. Well, actually, here it is.
Dank Ihrer Führung wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen, Heimat zu sein.
Heimat zu sein.
Heimat zu sein für alle Deutschen der Welt.
As hoped, people's hearts swelled with pride, and the beginning of an us-versus-them mentality was sown. Our land was the homeland, citizens thought. All others were simply foreign lands. We were the true people, he suggested, the only ones worthy of our nation's concern. Bombs fall on others, or human rights are violated in other nations, and it makes our lives better? It's of little concern to us. Playing on this new implicitly racial nationalism and exploiting a disagreement with the French over his increasing militarism, he argued that any international body that didn't act first and foremost in the best interest of his own nation was neither relevant nor useful, and thus withdrew his country from the League of Nations in October 1933 to negotiate a separate naval armaments agreement with Anthony Eden of the United Kingdom to create a worldwide military ruling elite with the UK. His propaganda minister orchestrated a campaign to ensure the people that he was a deeply religious man and that his motivations were rooted in Christianity. He even proclaimed the need for a revival of the Christian faith across his nation, what he called a new Christianity. Every man in his rapidly growing army wore a belt buckle that declared, Gott mit uns, God is with us. And most of them fervently believed it was true. And now to the caller's note. Within a year of the terrorist attack, the nation's leader determined that the various local police and federal agencies around the nation were lacking the clear communication and overall coordination necessary to deal with the terrorist threat facing the nation, particularly those citizens who were of Middle Eastern ancestry and thus probably terrorist and communist sympathizers and various troublesome intellectuals and liberals. He proposed a single new agency to protect the security of the homeland, consolidating the actions of dozens of previously independent police, border, and investigative agencies under a single central leader and department. Most Americans remember Hitler's Office for the Security of the Homeland, the Reichssicherheitsstaubamt, and its Schutzstaffel, simply by its most famous agency's initials, the SS. And es tut mir leid für mein schlecht Deutsch, for those who speak German. His assistant, who dealt with the press, noted that since the terrorist attack, radio and press are at our disposal. Those voices questioning the legitimacy of their nation's leader in the face of this new Department of Homeland Security. Those who were raising questions about his checkered past were now fading from the public's recollection as his central security office began advertising a program encouraging people to phone in tips about suspicious neighbors. To consolidate his power, he concluded the government alone wasn't enough. He reached out to industry and forged an alliance, bringing former executives of the nation's largest corporations, millionaires and billionaires, into high government positions. A flood of government money poured into corporate coffers to fight the war against the Middle Eastern ancestry terrorists lurking within the homeland and to prepare for wars overseas. He encouraged large corporations friendly to him to acquire media outlets and other industrial concerns across the nation, particularly those previously owned by these suspicious Middle Eastern people. He built powerful alliances with industry. One corporate ally got the lucrative contract worth millions to build the first large-scale detention center for enemies of the state. Soon more would follow. Industry flourished. He reached out to the churches, declaring that the nation had clear Christian roots and that any nation that didn't openly support religion was morally bankrupt. In a speech on April 12th, he said, "My feeling as a Christian points me to my Lord and Savior as a fighter. It points me to the man who once in loneliness, surrounded only by a few followers, was greatest not as a sufferer, but as a fighter. In boundless love as a Christian and as a man, I read through the passage which tells how the Lord at last rose in his might and seized the scourge to drive out of the temple the brood of vipers and adders. As a Christian, I have the duty to be a fighter for truth and justice." End of quote. From Adolf Hitler. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging conservative Tim Graham, who's claiming that Meredith Vieira has poisoned the Today Show with her liberal bias. And an update on what's happening with the world. Can't wait on October 5th. That and more and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Remember, my friends, democracy, if we're going to hang on to it, starts with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.